I want to read an excerpt to you from a publication called The Hill. I saw it online. I'm not sure if it's a published newsletter or if it's just an online publication. But it's a politically based publication or newsletter. This particular article was published on August the 3rd. It says the White House is recruiting for a new Middle East policy team ahead of the release of its long-awaited Middle East peace plan. Staffers joining the team will be assigned for 6 months to a year to serve on this new policy team. They'll be focusing on three areas: political and security details, as well as economic and strategic communications. White House senior advisor Jared Kushner is leading the peace efforts. They've held meetings recently with leaders in Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, and Israel, and what was deemed by the White House to be very productive meetings. However, Arab leaders, represented by Mahmoud Abbas of Palestine, refused to attend the meeting because they were warned ahead of time that the U.S. might not support the establishing of a Palestinian state. So, a Palestinian state. So, President Trump, in this case, is working with leaders in his White House, meeting with those, at least from some of the countries in the Arab world, working toward what they believe is going to be a plan for peace in the Middle East. Now, as far as I can remember, every president, at least in my lifetime, has had a plan for peace in the Middle East. And we see how that's working out. I think it's safe to say that the current efforts will fall short as well. As we've been emphasizing for the last couple of sermons, the roots of unrest in the Middle East go way back to ancient history. And we recognize that things are going to get much worse before they get any better. And there is no peace plan that will be devised by political leaders that will solve the issues in the Middle East. In recent sermons, we've been reviewing how some very different people with different agendas have come to populate and lay claim on the land of Canaan. The land of Canaan today, on your map, is labeled Israel. We know, of course, that Israel is itself a confusing misnomer because the people who live in that nation today are primarily descendants of Judah, which is only one of the 10 tribes that made up the nation of Israel in ancient times. We reviewed how, in a covenant, God established with Abraham that the land of Canaan was promised to his descendants. But long before any of Abraham's descendants arrived, others had fully occupied that territory, and they had no intention at all of letting it go. We're going to continue our history lesson or discussion this afternoon. The series that we're in the middle of is titled Origins of the Middle East Crisis. And the title I've given to the sermon today is Israel Enters the Promised Land. Israel Enters the Promised Land. We reviewed earlier the promises of that land. Now we'll see the time when Israel actually takes possession, or at least moves into the land that was to be given to them. Now, our purpose in doing this, just to give you an idea of where we are and where we're headed, is to review what to many of you is a familiar history of the journeys of Israel and their encounters as they entered the Promised Land. We want to establish that history because that history is what prophecy is built upon. It's how the events that will take place that are prophesied in that region at the end of the age. This helps explain how they come about, why those events will take place. So it's helpful to begin back at this point and work up to the understanding of what will happen in this area in the future. Now we read Exodus chapter 3, verse 8. Exodus chapter 3, verse 8. The people of descendants of Jacob, his 12 sons and their families, had grown to the point where they were a population of something between 2.5 and 3 million people. And they were enslaved in Egypt. But a promise was made to them. And we'll just pick up in the middle of this statement. Prior to this, God says that he's seen the oppression that his people are under in Egypt. And he knows their sorrows. Verse 8, "So I have come down to deliver them out of the hands of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites." To fulfill his covenant promise to Abraham, God was going to establish Abraham's descendants in this land of Canaan, which he described as a land flowing with milk and honey. That, of course, is a poetic or symbolic language. Flowing with milk and honey represents a land of abundance, a land with fertile pastures for their cattle and sheep, a land abundant with grass and flowers, producing fruit crops and honey, a place that will be far different from the oppressive life they had been living in the land of Egypt, to a place that would be their own nation and their own home. So God rescued the people of Israel from Egypt. When they left Egypt, they were taken on a route that was much more difficult than they had anticipated. God knew what he was doing, but the people of Israel really weren't prepared, or at least not mentally prepared, for the challenges that lay ahead. It took approximately, and you can go back and read through the timeline or the account here, it took approximately 18 months for Israel to walk from Egypt to the southern border of Canaan. And at that point, after that long and difficult journey, they were preparing to enter into the land of their promised inheritance. During that time, God led them, first of all, to Mount Sinai. About 6 weeks after they left Israel, after they left Egypt, I'm sorry, they arrived at the foot of Mount Sinai, and they remained camped there for about a year. God established his covenant with them, and he was teaching them how to be his people, teaching them about his law, teaching them how to treat one another, how to organize a nation. As you read through the book of Leviticus, you see the regulations and the rules that were established for how they would become a society. Now, Israel was in no condition to just immediately become a nation. They had to be taught. They had to be taught how to live as a community as a nation. And they had to be taught to honor and to worship the God of Abraham, who was going to bring them to the land of their promise. We get to Numbers chapter 13, and we see here where Israel approaches the land for the first time, the place that God had promised to them. This land flowing with milk and honey. In verse 1 of Numbers 13, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel." So they were sent to see what the land was going to be like. Made sense to send someone ahead so that they could come back and and report to the people what they were about to find. Verse 17, Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan. And he said to them, go up this way into the south and go up to the mountains. Now, they were in the southern area of the wilderness of Paran, just south of where Judah or Israel was eventually established. And he told them to go up now through the central part of the nation into the mountains and see what the land is like. Check things out. Whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many, whether the land they dwell in is good or bad, whether the cities they inhabit are like camps or like strongholds, whether the land is rich or poor, and whether the forests there are forests or not. But he said, be of good courage and bring back some of the fruit of the land. Now, the time was the season of the first ripe grapes. That's one of the clues we have as to when it was that Israel was coming into this area. This would be in the late summer or fall when the grapes were ripening and ready to be harvested. So Moses sent the people and or the spies, one from each tribe, and they were to come back and report on the cities, the land, the people, the topography, just the general condition that they were about to encounter. Now, we know what happened. We know that they went into this land, and as they returned, they did bring back samples of what they had found. They went up, verse 21, and spied out the land, and the area described here is basically in the central part of what became the nation of Judah, the central area of Canaan. And they brought back some fruit that they had gathered, clusters of grapes, some pomegranates, and to give evidence of how fertile the land was. It was truly a very productive land. Verse 27, they said, we went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. So, maybe it was a little bit like how we might feel if we drive through some part of our country and we see how beautiful the landscape is and how productive it is. And just we've all gone in drives and maybe on your way to the Feast of Tabernacles or wherever you might be going. And it's just there's some spectacular things to see as we're traveling through the nation that we live in. And so that's what the spies found. This is a beautiful place. It flows with milk and honey. It's rich. It's fertile. There's so much here that is just what God promised it would be. Nevertheless, verse 28, the people who dwell in the land are strong. Now Moses said, check it out. See if they just live in little camps or if they live in strongholds. Well, it turns out they're strong. Their cities are fortified and very large. And we even saw descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land to the south. And the various tribes of Canaan, it says, dwell in the mountains. I'm sorry, some of them dwell in the mountains, and they also dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan. The people, they reported, are fierce. Let me read this to you in the New International Version. Verse 28 in the New International says, but the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. Verse 31, the men who had gone up said, we cannot attack these people. They are stronger than we are. And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. They said, the land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes when we looked at them. So they were intimidated by what they saw. They saw the beauty of the land, and yet they also saw that this was not someplace they just were going to stroll into and take over. Now, usually when we read this section of Scripture, and we've been through this many times before, we emphasize Israel's lack of faith, which certainly was the primary lesson, I think, of their experience. But we need to consider what Canaan looked like from Israel's perspective. For hundreds of years, this was land that had been claimed and occupied by Canaanites, Philistines, and Amalekites. Remember, the Amalekites are descendants of Esau. Philistines are tribes that migrated from Egypt, and of course, the many Canaanite tribes. These were fierce and warlike people. But until just a year and a half before, the Israelites had been a passive and a peaceful people. For generations, they'd lived in slavery. They had few, if any, weapons. They had no way to defend themselves, much less attack these fierce people. They had no experience in warfare. The Canaanites were already there. They were already established in this region, even when Abraham moved there. If you go back to Genesis 12, verse 5, Abraham is told to go to the land of the Canaanites. They were already there in 1897 B.C. when Abraham moved into the region. Now, here comes Israel, 450 years later. So the people in Canaan were deeply entrenched. They had history, they had culture. This was their land as far as they were concerned. By comparison, just to give you an idea, the first settlement in the United States, first English settlement on this continent, was Jamestown, Virginia, which was established 400 years ago. And consider how this nation has developed in that period of time. So my point is that the Canaanites were dug in. Notice what we find in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 10. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 10. This is what Israel was to inherit. Now, we're jumping ahead here from where we were in Numbers 13. We're going clear to the end of their 40 years, just before they went in. But this is the way the land is described. Deuteronomy 6, verse 10. So it shall be when the Lord your God brings you into the land of which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you large and beautiful cities which you did not build, houses full of good things which you did not fill, hewn out wells which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant. Again, this is a description of a civilization that is already in place. And they had, again, as I said, they had their history, they had their family, they had their culture. This was, from their perspective, their land. So the Israelite spies saw all this. Now, all this was to be given to Israel, but it wasn't going to be just handed to them. This was going to be a whole lot more difficult than they had expected. The people were fierce, and as the spies put it, they're going to eat us alive. They were fearful of the giants they found there. The descendants of Anak were apparently a Philistine tribe. Remember Goliath. Goliath was a Philistine. And you find in 1 Samuel 16 that Goliath was about 10 feet tall. So that's a pretty good sized guy. When I was in college, I was on the little intramural basketball team. And one of the guys on the team I played against was actually had been a semi-pro basketball player in Europe. And he was 6'10". And I felt like a grasshopper in his eyes. I mean, I couldn't, any place I was on the court, he could reach clear across the court and swat the ball away. So I didn't enjoy a lot playing against this giant of a guy. And he was only 6'10". Add another 3.5 feet to that, to what a typical giant probably would have been like. So yeah, this would have been intimidating. So let's go back to Numbers 14 again. Verses 6 through 9, we see that the only ones of the, only of, ones of the spies who still expressed faith in God were Joshua and Caleb. So God was appreciated their faithfulness, and they were rewarded for it later. Verses 10 through 19, we just kind of glanced through this. God was angry with the people. After all he had done to prove himself to them, the people took one look at the others in the land, and they decided that they would rather go back where they had come from. This, of course, upset God a great deal. In fact, he decided to destroy all of them and start over with Moses. But Moses begged God to be forgiving, and God relented, and he spared the people of Israel. However, that generation of Israel who had witnessed the miracles, who should have had faith in God, who balked at going into the land, would not live to see that inheritance. They would not survive. Verse 25, drop down into the story here. It says, the Amalekites and the Canaanites dwell in the valley. So tomorrow, this is God's instruction to the people of Israel. You don't want to go into this land. You're fearful of it, afraid that I won't protect you. So tomorrow, turn around and go back into the wilderness. You don't have to face these people if you don't think you can. Just turn around and go back into the desert. Well, of course, the people were not really excited about that option either. So God went on in the verses 26 through 38 to explain that this generation that had been unfaithful and doubting him would wander in the desert, so that it will be a total of 40 years after they left Egypt before they would enter the land. And that generation that had witnessed, those who were 20 years of age and older, when they left Egypt, would die in the desert. The little children that they feared for would grow up in the desert, and then they would inherit the land. So again, faced with this prospect, the people decided, well, now maybe let's go ahead and go in after all. You know, after hearing what's going to happen, and after God being so upset with them, let's go ahead and go after all. Verse 39. Moses told the people these words, and the people mourned greatly. And they rose early in the morning, and they went to the top of the mountain and said, well, okay, here we are. We're willing now to go to the place where the Lord has promised, for we've sinned. And they acknowledged that they were wrong for not being trusting of God in the first place. But they decided, okay, now we've changed our mind. Now we'll go ahead and go into the land. But it was too late. The door was closed. God was not going to go with them if they tried. And of course, they did. Moses warned them, verse 42, do not go up. You'll be defeated by your enemies, for the Lord is not among you. God was not with them because they had turned their back on him. For the Amalekites and the Canaanites are there before you, and you shall fall by the sword because you've turned away from the Lord, and he will not be with you. But they presumed to go up to the mountaintop anyway. Nevertheless, neither the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord nor Moses went with them. Then Amalek and the Canaanites who dwelt in that mountain came down and attacked them and drove them back as far as Hormah. So they, first of all, refused to believe and trust God, and secondly, they didn't obey God when he told them to turn around and not to try to enter the land. This was their first attempt to enter the land was a real fail. It didn't go at all the way it was supposed to. Let's fast forward now, 38 and a half years after Israel has been wandering in the wilderness. Again, they spent a year and a half to get there, and now they have spent 38 and a half more years for a total of 40 before they would actually enter the land. Deuteronomy chapter 20. This book of Deuteronomy is a review of God's laws and of God's commands to this second generation that had come out of Egypt. These were young, some of them very young, some of them probably actually born in the wilderness. These were the ones that God would send into Canaan. And so, to prepare them, there's a very lengthy and detailed review that's given in the book of Deuteronomy in terms of God's instructions, how Israel should worship God and honor God. Many of the laws that you find in other previous books are repeated here in Deuteronomy for that purpose. Verses 1 through 15 describe how Israel is to be prepared for war after they enter into the land. When you go to battle, verse 1, against your enemies, and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt. God reminds them, as they are now about to enter the land again, gives them a general instruction about how to deal with a situation of warfare. He goes on in the next several verses to describe the kind of men who are fit to serve in the army of Israel. Not everyone was. Those who were fearful, those who were divided in their what they were committed to, were not allowed to be part of the fighting, the troops or the army of Israel. That's described all the way down through verse 15. It's a very general description. It's about their battles in a general sense. Now, there's something more specific, though, that follows. That tells them how to deal with the nations that they might battle against in the future. But verse 16. Of the cities of these peoples, which your Lord God gives you as an inheritance, you shall let nothing that breathes remain alive. When Israel was to do battle in other circumstances, the way they would do so was described in the previous verses. But verse 16 says, for those cities now that you're going to move in, that are your inheritance in your land, when you go to battle with them, let nothing remain alive. You shall utterly destroy them. The Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, Hivite, Jebusite, just as the Lord your God has commanded you, you shall utterly destroy all of these people. Genocide. God intended that they completely wipe out. This is a scorched earth policy. Nothing survives. Sounds pretty cruel, doesn't it? Sounds pretty mean, pretty ugly. After all, many of these people would be women, children, people who are innocent, just going about their lives. It's where they grew up. It's what they call home. God says, destroy every single one. Why would he do that? What was the problem? Well, continue. Just as the Lord your God has commanded you, verse 18, lest they teach you to do according to all their abominations, which they have done for their gods, and you sin against the Lord your God. The reason for this policy, for this approach, was so that they would remove every vestige, every part of the Canaanite culture, because God knew that if it remained, they would be drawn into it. He knew that they would be drawn into doing what the other nations practiced. So the solution is simple. The solution is obvious, and it's effective. Do away with everything in their culture. So what did Israel do? What did they accomplish? Well, let's jump ahead again, another 25 or so years, to Joshua chapter 11. Joshua chapter 11, verse 16. They conquered the land. You remember they came in, they took Jericho, first of all, then there was Ai, and then there's a whole string of cities that are described that the people of Israel were able to subdue and to conquer. Eventually, verse 16, it says, thus Joshua took all the land. Eventually, all the area of Canaan had been addressed. And if you compare this, I won't take a lot of time, but compare this to chapter 14, verse 10. You see some details about the life of Caleb, and you see, piece it together, that it took 5 years from the time Israel first crossed the Jordan River into Jericho until they reached this point where it says that they had, Joshua took all the land. They now controlled the land of Canaan. The land of Canaan had now become the nation of Israel. They had taken that control. But as they did so, there were still some Canaanites that needed to be driven out. They'd taken the land, they'd taken control, but there was still more work to be done. Notice chapter 13, verse 1. Joshua was old and advanced in years, and the Lord said to him, you're old and advanced in years, and there remains very much land yet to be possessed. This is the land that yet remains. And he goes on to list all the different territories of the Philistines and the various tribes that were still under the control of the Canaanites. Notice, however, that God is going to continue to be with them. At the end of verse 6, he says, I will drive them out from before the children of Israel. So for now, he says, divide the land between the tribes. Have everyone take their territory. But there is still more work to be done before all of the Canaanite tribes have been dealt with. And so from this chapter on through chapter 18, you see a description of the division of the land of Canaan, or now the nation of Israel, among the tribes of Israel. So, the war was over, but it wasn't over. They'd conquered, they now controlled the land, but there still were pockets, there still were areas that needed to be dealt with, apparently quite a few, and some pretty extensive areas where the Canaanites still were part of the land. Chapter 21, verse 43. Chapter 21, verse 43. Kind of a summary statement, telling us that God upheld his end of the bargain. If anything doesn't go right, it's not because God failed the people in any way. Chapter 21, verse 43. The Lord gave to Israel all the land of which he had sworn to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it, and they dwelt in it. Again, the land of Canaan had become the nation of Israel. The Lord gave them rest all around, according to all that he had sworn to their fathers, and not a man of all their enemies stood against them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand. Now, we can take from this that there were still enemies. There was still some struggle going on. There was still some fighting taking place, but God was taking care of his people and establishing them. Verse 45, not a word failed of any good thing which the Lord had spoken to the house of Israel. All came to pass. God's promise to Abraham was certain and secure, and God delivered his descendants into the land of promise. This was some 400 years after the promise had been initially given to Abraham. But the war against the Canaanites, as we see, was continuing. God was with them, but they still had to do their part, which was to destroy all of the Canaanites from the land. Let's go ahead now to the book of Judges. Judges chapter 1. We see that the war against the Canaanites was continuing. Verse 1, Judges chapter 1. After the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, "Who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" So the first tribe to take on this situation was the tribe of Judah, by the instruction of God in verse 2. But as we kind of glance down through the chapter, we'll find something that's pretty disturbing. Verse 19 here in this chapter. Verse 19 says the Lord was with Judah as they were sent to do battle with those Canaanites still in the land, and they drove out the mountaineers, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron. They were more advanced in terms of their military. Judah could not drive out all of the Canaanites who were in their land. Verse 21, the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites. Verse 27, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and its villages. And a number of other villages are listed. Verse 29, nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gezer. Verse 30, nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants. Verse 31, nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants. See a trend here? Verse 31, nor did Naphtali. Verse 34, it got worse. The Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains. They turned the tables on them, and the people of Dan were put on the run. So the people of Israel, although they had come into the land, and they now controlled the land enough that it was their territory, it was their nation, were not able to completely drive out the Canaanites. Chapter 2. The angel of the Lord, and this phrase has come up a number of times recently in both the Bible study and in our this review of the history of Israel. The angel of the Lord is, angel means messenger. The messenger of the Lord refers to a physical representation of the Word, the one who became Jesus Christ. He was used in certain cases to either deliver information or a message as the angel or messenger of God, the Word, or to intervene on behalf of the people. So the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, "I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars," which reject the culture that was there. "But you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you not done this? Why have you not destroyed the Canaanites as you were told that you must? Therefore, I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare to you." So what happened was the people of Canaan survived in the land, and the people of Israel coexisted with them. Now, if you go back and look at those where we just read, where the tribe after tribe failed to drive out the Canaanites, it said that They had them. They didn't drive them out, but they were in subjection. They became slaves to the people of Israel. That was kind of a compromise that the people came up with. It wasn't what God had told them to do. They dominated them, but of course, they were still there. Their culture, their religion, their worship was still there. And Israel, just as God predicted, was drawn into the Canaanite ways. They became a snare to them, just as they had been warned long before they went in they had been warned that this would happen if they did not eradicate the people of the land. Chapter 2, verse 7. We find another development here. It says, "So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord, which he had done for Israel." We'll see here that there's a tendency that people have to drift away when the leadership is not strong. This is a dangerous thing for people, but it seems to be something that is a natural tendency. Joshua says in verse 8, "The son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old. Verse 10, "When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel." When Joshua died, there were some elders who continued after him. And as long as that group of men who were elders, who were leaders, who knew Joshua were still alive, the people still continued to follow God. But after that generation had gone, then the people had begun to stray from, because they didn't have the leaders that would keep them following God. Let's glance back to chapter 24 of Joshua, verse 31, just at the last page in the book of Joshua. The same point is made here. "Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. But as soon as that generation passed, we saw that the people did not remember the work that God had done for Israel." That's a very dangerous tendency for people to have. We can pause and even just kind of gain a lesson from that for ourselves. How long can God's church continue? Will it continue beyond one generation of leaders to the next generation of leaders? Will the next generation continue to uphold and to live according to the understanding that God has revealed? First of all, the people of Israel had failed to eliminate the Canaanites. Back to Judges 2, verse 11. Judges 2, verse 11. So, after that generation who knew God and saw his intervention for Israel in the wilderness and as they came into the land, after that generation had passed, verse 11, "Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. They served the Baals, and they forsook the Lord God of their fathers." Why were the Baals still there? Why was that option, that way of pagan worship, even in existence? Well, because the people of Israel had failed to eliminate it when they had the chance. They forsook the Lord God of their fathers who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them. And they bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They forsook the Lord. They served Baal and their Ashereths. The anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he delivered them into their plunderers. Think about how quickly this turned around. There was a generation that left Egypt. They died in the wilderness. The second generation grew up in the wilderness and moved into the land of Canaan, but they didn't fully subdue the land. The very next generation turned back to the gods of the land. People turned around so quickly. Within 45 years after they had entered Canaan, they had turned to the pagan worship. This again illustrates the importance, and we can draw a lesson for ourselves, of maintaining the truth of God and a commitment to it. Now, with God's Spirit and with the promise that Jesus gave that his church would continue to exist, we can anticipate that the church will continue. But individually, we still need to make that decision from one generation to the next, and to not stray from or wander from what God has revealed. And you find that the church has a pretty strong emphasis on the importance of teaching the next generation and reminding and of the way that we have been drawn into and the importance of being faithful to God. They obviously, you know, to turn around that quickly, they didn't get it, did they? They didn't really get it. Now, again, they weren't converted. We know that. They were, but still, even just humanly, you'd think that they would be difficult to make it that change that quickly. Just for to make a comparison, turn back to Exodus chapter 13. Exodus chapter 13. See, God built into his instruction a way that if they had followed, would have avoided this turnaround that they experienced, the turning back to the gods of the land. Exodus chapter 13, verse 3. You remember this, where we are here? This is back to the very first Passover. They're still in Egypt. They've just had the first Passover. And God is, in chapter 12, they're leaving the land of Egypt with a high hand. And chapter 13 kind of is a summary teaching chapter. Moses said to the people in verse 3, "Remember this day when you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord has brought you out of this place." Verse 4, "On this day you're going out in the month of Abib, the first month, and it shall be, when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Hivites, and Jebusites, that land which he swore to give to your fathers, a land flowing with milk and honey, you shall keep this service in its month." Why? Why were they to keep the Passover and the days of unleavened bread? 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day will be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten for 7 days. No leavened bread. Verse 8. "And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, 'This is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up out of Egypt.'" This was the lesson to be taught from one generation to the next. And the reason that they were to observe the days of unleavened bread, because you see, the third generation that we're talking about, they never set foot in Egypt. That just was stories that they heard about. But that's what they were to learn from. They were to be taught from one generation to the next. We observe these days because, we remember because, We know what God did for our forefathers, and this is how we are reminded and we worship God. And we're to do that, it says, when you come into that land of the Canaanites. They obviously really didn't. There's not much record beyond this point of the people of Israel observing those days. Now you find an occasional revival among the kings of Judah, where the worship was restored. But for the most part, they just didn't get it. Deuteronomy 6, verse 10. Same thing, same point. This is, again, Exodus 13 is 40 years before. Deuteronomy 6, we've jumped ahead 40 years again. We keep jumping back and forth here. Deuteronomy 6, verse 10. So it shall be when the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers. Now, they're not there yet. They're just on the, just nearly ready to go back in on the second try. The first time they failed for 38 years back in the desert. Now they're about ready to go back in again. And here's a lesson to remember as you go back in. He'll give you these lands, the beautiful cities you didn't build, the houses that are full of good things you didn't fill, hewn out wells you didn't dig. We've read this already. Then it says, when you've eaten and are full, then beware lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. But they did forget. The people of Israel created this situation for themselves because they didn't obey God in the first place by destroying the Canaanites, and then they didn't continue to observe and remember what God had taught them through their time in Egypt, their time in the wilderness, and their time conquering the land. So we've been here in the early chapter of Judges, Judges 1 and 2. The time of the judges that is described or summarized in this book continued for another 300 years. For 300 years, the nation was pretty disorganized. From time to time, they would have a strong judge who would arise and help them or lead them to some bit of repentance, but then they would fall back into their old patterns. It was a cycle that repeated. Finally, after 300 years, Saul became the first king of Israel in 1048 BC. And then this united monarchy, which means all of the tribes combined into one nation, continued under David and Solomon. So for 120 years, the nations of Israel and Judah were one and the same. They were the nation of Israel. Just to summarize, both of the nations, Israel and Judah, continued in the rebellion we see that started in Judges chapter 2. Eventually, they both were evicted from the land of promise. The land of promise that was given to them was taken away. They were dismissed from the land that God had promised to give to Abraham's descendants. Israel in 721 BC, Judah in 585 BC. So, a little more than 800 years after coming into Canaan, they were removed from. They came into their own land, and 800 years later, they were removed. But the promised inheritance of Abraham, in particular through the descendants of Joseph, continues to this day. We won't take the time, but I would encourage you to read again the United States and British Commonwealth in prophecy to see how that promise to Abraham in a physical sense was fulfilled even after the people were evicted from the land of Israel, the land of their promise. As a result, now a small fraction of one tribe remains in what once was the land of Israel. As I mentioned before, it's called Israel, but it's not really Israel. One, even just a portion of one tribe, the tribe of Judah, remains in that land today. But that land, and the city of Jerusalem in particular, are surrounded by all of the descendants of those tribes, of the Canaanites, the Philistines, the Amalekites, and others who surround that region. Because of the inherent hostility between the people that still are in that land and the intent of that small tribe of Judah that remains in the land, there is an intense and bitter rivalry and fight for that land. And that land in general of Canaan, or Israel, and the city of Jerusalem in particular, will soon be the focal point of world-changing events. This, in a very brief summary, is how it got to be that volatile. How the hatred grew between the people and the cultures. There are other aspects, and we may have an opportunity to review some of them. The rise of the Muslim religion was certainly a very critical part of the conditions that we have in the Middle East today. There are more Arabs and Muslims than there are Christians. This tiny nation of Israel is surrounded by hundreds of millions of enemies who are intent on taking back that land. And they're not going to be dissuaded by an American president who is better off running hotels. There's some interesting times ahead, and they're going to focus in this region of the Middle East. As we approach the Feast of Trumpets, these prophecies become much more relevant and they come into focus. And as we approach that very special time, which represents Jesus Christ's intervention and his return to this earth, when he will solve the issues in the Middle East, we'll continue that review in the next couple of Sabbaths.